In addition to MCAST, a subscription to emedhome.com includes over 1,000 video lectures from the best EM conferences, with more added all the time. View on any device whenever and wherever you want. All this and so much more, including hundreds of CME credits each year for the low cost of only $99. emedhome.com. For 20 years, the homepage of emergency medicine. Subscribe now.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to EMED Home's EM Cast. My name is Amol Mattu, and I'm coming at you from the University of Maryland School of Medicine. I hope everybody's year is moving along very nicely. I hope you all are staying safe and healthy, and your families are doing well as well in what is now, I guess, the seventh wave of COVID. Hopefully, things are going a lot better for all of you out there. And again, staying safe. Anyway, let's move on to the EM Cast for this month. This month, we only have two topics, but they are really, really great topics. We're going to kick things off with fan favorite Dr. Mike Winters. Mike does an annual lecture at AAEM, the American Academy of Emergency Medicine, on resuscitation literature updates. And I snagged him to review the topics that he covered for EM Cast. And he went through a number of really great literature updates from the past year focused on cardiac arrest and some intubation issues and some IV fluid issues. And this is going to end up being, although it's a longer podcast in general, it's a whole bunch of little mini topics that he's going to be addressing. Very, very practical stuff that we all need to know when we are managing cardiac arrest and other types of sick patients that are in need of resuscitation. So Mike is going to kick things off with that. And then we're going to go to Dr. David Carr. David is a very gifted educator from Toronto, and I've known him for a handful of years, but he's never been on the EM Cast before, and hopefully this won't be his last time. I hope to get him back again as much as we can. But he sent out a poll on Twitter that was very interesting, and it had to do with just getting people's opinions about how to properly and expeditiously and successfully do an emergency department consult. What are the things that your consultants want to hear on the phone when you call them up? What are the things that maybe you should be telling them just to really make the consult communication process very, very efficient? He got a lot of really great feedback, and when I saw that come across the Twitterverse, I contacted him and said, David, you've got to share these tips with all of our EMCast listeners. And so we're going to spend some time talking about that, which is, as all of you out there that have been practicing emergency medicine for a number of years, you know how valuable of a skill it is to be able to successfully consult your consultants. And even those of us that have been out for a couple of decades will still learn something from this this discussion. So anyway, with that, let's go ahead and get started with the June issue. All right. Well, kicking things off for EMCast this month, I have Mike Winters. As many of you know, Mike Winters is one of our faculty who does a lot of high risk type of stuff, critical care lecturing. And most recently, he did a resuscitation literature update at the American Academy of Emergency Medicine annual scientific assembly. And he does these resuscitation literature updates every year. And it is time for the Dr. Winters resuscitation literature update. So, Mike, first of all, welcome back to the EM Cast, and thanks for putting these articles together for all of us, including those listeners on EM Cast. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me here, Amol, and giving me the opportunity to spend a little bit more time with listeners to EM Cast. It is greatly appreciated.
Great, great. Well, I have to admit, I missed your lecture at AAEM because I was working clinically, so that some other folks could attend the conference. But as always, I heard some really great things, and I saw a little outline of the topics that you're addressing, and they look like really, really fantastic topics. So why don't we just go ahead and jump in, and you can tell us what we need to know about the literature of the past year. And we'll start out with, let's see, the first topic you sent was cardiac arrest. You covered a couple of articles that focused on cardiac arrest from the past year. So take us through what updates we need to know from the literature about cardiac arrest.
Absolutely, Amol. I think let's start off with what I think is the quintessential emergency medicine resuscitative state, and that is cardiac arrest. And throughout this discussion, we're not going to go into p-values and odds ratios and all sorts of things, but we're going to just touch on the key take-home pearls from literature that has been published in the last, I would say, 6 to 9 months. regarding a few critical and key resuscitative topics here in emergency medicine. So to that end, with respect to cardiac arrest, what I'm going to focus on are three articles that were published in the last year pertaining to medication use when we have somebody presenting with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And recall that perhaps one of our prior podcasts, we reviewed the AHA 2020 update in terms of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, emergency cardiovascular care. We're not going to go through that guideline update, but recall that they continue to endorse epinephrine as a class one medication or class one recommendation, giving 1 milligram every 3 to 5 minutes and try to give it early in those with a non-shockable rhythm and only give it after defibrillation in those with a shockable rhythm. And the first article really was published just about a year ago, 10 or 11 months ago, and this is in Resuscitation. Now, a few years ago, we talked about the Paramedic 2 trial. Recall that the Paramedic 2 trial was a trial performed in over 8,000 patients in the UK that were randomized to either get epi or placebo, and they looked at 30-day survival. And what they found is that in patients who were randomized to get epi, well, yes, there were a few more alive at 30 days, but it did not change hospital discharge with meaningful neurologic survival. In fact, those that got epi compared to placebo or saline actually had a more severe neurologic impairment compared to those that were given placebo. So this particular study, lead author was Haywood, published in Resuscitation, was looking at the long-term survival. What do I mean by long-term? Well, 6 and 12 month survival in patients randomized to either epi or sodium chloride and out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. In essence, they did a whole bunch of surveys, follow-ups to really get at long-term meaningful survival at that 6 and 12 month mark. And well, the take-home message, similar to the initial Paramedic 2 trial, was that at 6 months, there were a few more patients alive that got epi compared to those that got placebo. But when you looked at what I would say is the most important outcome, favorable neurologic outcome, there actually wasn't any difference. And in fact, those that were alive at 6 months and got epi were more severely neurologic impaired compared to those that got sodium chloride. What about 12 months? Yes, a few more patients at 12 months were alive compared to those that got epi compared to those that received placebo, but there was no difference in favorable neurologic survival. So now we've got a follow-up study to say that while epinephrine may improve survival at 6 and 12 months, it does not change the incidence or the number of patients alive with meaningful neurologic outcome. So that's epi. Let's transition to another medication commonly used in cardiac arrest resuscitation, and that is calcium. So think to yourself, your last resuscitation. All of our listeners, the last resuscitation, cardiac arrest resuscitation you've had, how many were thinking or actually gave calcium in hopes of improving ROSC, getting ROSC, and maybe hopefully survival to hospital admission? Well, the COCA trial was published about 7-8 months ago in JAMA. This was a randomized double-blind trial performed in Denmark, looking at whether calcium in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest actually improved ROSC rates. So they had adults out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Now, importantly, they did not include patients whereby calcium was indicated. So if there was a strong suspicion of hyperkalemia, those patients were included in the COCA trial. If there was a overdose, so let's just say a calcium channel blocker, those weren't the patients included in this particular trial, Amal. This was undifferentiated cardiac arrest. And those that were enrolled were randomized either to get calcium, IV or IO, after the first dose of epi, and they could receive a second dose, or they were randomized to sodium chloride. The primary outcome looking at sustained ROSC for 20 minutes, followed by secondary outcomes of 30-day survival and then 30-day survival with favorable neurologic outcome. Well, the take-home message is the trial was stopped early after a little over 380 patients because there was no statistically different ROSC rates in those that receive calcium versus those that receive placebo. In fact, there was a trend towards better ROSC in those that got the sodium chloride compared to the calcium. Similar message, no change in 30-day survival, and most importantly, no change in 30-day survival with favorable neurologic outcome between patients who got calcium and those that got sodium chloride. So the take-home message from the COCA trial is really the administration of calcium to patients with undifferentiated cardiac arrest did not result in an increase in ROSC, did not improve 30-day survival, and did not improve 30-day survival with meaningful neurologic outcome, with the caveat being that when it's indicated, hyperkalemia, tox, or calcium channel blocker overdose, those patients weren't enrolled in this particular study. And lastly, Amal, from a medication standpoint, you may recall way back in 2009, in 2013, investigators out of Greece took a look at the combination of vasopressin and methylprednisolone for patients with in-hospital cardiac arrest. And what they found is that there was an increase in ROSC rate and survival to hospital discharge. However, we really had nothing since 2013. And the AHA, the European Resuscitation Council, really haven't strongly endorsed vasopressin, methylprednisolone, in addition to epinephrine, but we haven't really had a randomized trial to say, should we consider it or should we not? Until the last several months when we've had the VAM-IHCA trial published, also in JAMA, a randomized trial also just like the COCA trial performed in Denmark to say, does this combination of essentially vasopressin and steroids improved ROSC rates in adults? Now, this is important, in hospital cardiac arrest. So the one drawback or limitation is that they did not include out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, but this study still informs us of this medication pairing in terms of in-hospital cardiac arrest. So what did the investigators do? Patients were randomized either to get vasopressin and steroids after the first dose of epinephrine. They could receive it up to three additional times after subsequent epi doses, or they were randomized to sodium chloride. Very similar to the COCA trial, they were looking at sustained ROSC for 20 minutes as their primary outcome, with secondary outcomes being 30-day survival and 30-day survival with meaningful neurologic recovery. What were the take-home results? A little over 500 patients. In essence, yes, the combination of vasopressin and methylprednisolone did increase the percentage of patients that got ROSC compared to those that received placebo. However, there was no significant difference in 30-day survival. And once again, the most important outcome, no difference in 30-day survival with favorable neurologic outcome. So, Amal, when we take a look at recent resuscitation articles, drilling down on the ones that have been published in the last 6 to 9 months, looking at our medication use in cardiac arrest, we've got the long-term follow-up on EPI and the Paramedic 2 trial demonstrating that while it may tick up a few more patients that are alive at 6 and 12 months, it does not change the amount of patients who actually survive with meaningful neurologic recovery. In terms of calcium, it is not recommended to routinely administer this medication in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patients with undifferentiated etiologies. And then lastly, I think we can now close the book on this vasopressin methylprednisolone combination in terms of while it may increase ROSC rates, at least in an in-hospital cardiac arrest patient population, it does not change 30-day survival or 30-day survival with meaningful neurologic recovery.
Great summary for the cardiac arrest stuff. So not to imply that we should use medication simply because there's no harm, but there will, I'm sure, be some people that turn around and say, well, if there's no harm to giving calcium, then why not use it? So you mentioned that there is perhaps a trend towards a better outcome with normal saline. And then the same thought could be applied to the vasopressin adrenaline. Is this something that you would argue against doing if somebody said, well, if there's no harm, I want to do it anyway?
So the AHA in the latest 2020 guidelines actually comes out as a Class 3 potentially harmful, not beneficial recommendation on calcium and even bicarbonate. So you've got national guidelines saying don't give it in an undifferentiated setting. And I personally am not one to routinely give calcium unless I have a suspicion that this could be hyperkalemia. This is a tox case. So I'm definitely not giving it in all of the cardiac arrest resuscitations that I work in with respect to our residents and attempting to resuscitate.
Sure. Sure. And of course, just throwing extra medications into the mix, which really don't prove any benefit, is probably a setup for errors in terms of medications that could be given. And also it probably distracts people from the things that do work. For example, good compressions and rapid defibrillation. So, okay, well, good. I like that. And that does make things simple. Now, what about if you follow all the guidelines, you do good quality compressions, you do rapid defibrillations when indicated, and let's say you do get pulses back, you get return of spontaneous circulation. What's new with regards to the post-arrest care of patients?
So that there's a lot to talk about, but we're only going to touch on just a few things here, Amal. Now, you know that this is one of my favorite topics to talk about, post-arrest care, because I think that all of us listening to this podcast, when we're in an emergency department setting and we achieve ROSC, there's some concrete but yet very meaningful things that we can do to really give our patients the greatest chance of getting out of the hospital with meaningful neurologic survival. And leaning from the 2020 update and prior iterations from the AHA, focusing on oxygenation, ventilation, optimizing hemodynamics with the right mean arterial pressure, detecting seizures, getting patients off to cath who should go off to cath, and then TTM really forms the foundation or the big pillars in post-arrest care when patients are with us in the emergency department. Now, we've talked about most of those things before, but a recent article that I want to highlight, it deals with blood pressure management. And we've talked before in EMCast that in the post-arrest setting, the literature is really moving in a direction of targeting a higher MAP than what we're used to when resuscitating, say, sepsis, where we're targeting a MAP of 65. And the literature is moving in a direction of targeting a higher MAP of, say, 75 to 80 millimeters of mercury. And as you know, this is what our target MAP is at Maryland in the immediate post-resus period. Now, to achieve that higher MAP, and just given the hemodynamic lability of many of our post-arrest patients, many are going to be on pressors. So that begs the question, is there a preferred pressor in the post-arrest setting? Now, to that end, there is a study that just got published actually in the last 2 to 3 months, Amal, out of intensive care medicine. This was an observational trial out of France. So not a randomized trial, but an observational trial helping to inform us, in which they took a look at patients that had post-arrest circulatory shock, needed vasopressors, and they got either epinephrine or norepinephrine. And they wanted to look at, well, in these patients getting either epi or norepi, what was the all-cause in-hospital mortality associated with those pressors? And as a secondary outcome, what was the unfavorable neurologic status at hospital discharge? So in this observational trial, they gathered almost 770 patients, and roughly the percentage of patients that got norepi was around 60%, and around 40% essentially got epinephrine. And that primary outcome of all-cause in-hospital mortality, well, that was higher in those that were put on an epinephrine infusion. Similarly, the number of patients that had persistent and refractory shock was higher in those on epi. The number of patients that developed recurrent cardiac arrest actually was higher in those that were receiving an epinephrine infusion. And what I've said already in the cardiac arrest literature, but when we look at unfavorable neurologic outcome, that was higher in those that were receiving an epinephrine infusion versus those that were receiving a norepinephrine infusion. And when they ran all the numbers, their propensity analysis, it was an epi infusion that was associated, admittedly, with a non-significant, but an increase in all-cause hospital mortality. Now, one caveat I would say, one limitation is when you drill down, you look at the patients, those that got epi probably were on the sicker side. in essence, there was higher rates of non-shockable rhythms. It took them a little bit longer to get ROSC. They had higher lactate, lower pH values on admission. But it certainly, this helps, or this informs us in terms of this particular study, and that when we're driving for higher MAPS, or we have patients with persistent circulatory shock in the post-arrest setting, well, maybe we should be reaching and think about norepi over using an epinephrine infusion. Now, the second article I wanted to touch on, and we're not really going to get into the TTM2 debate, Amal, because that was published really in the spring, early summer of last year. And I think we've discussed that also previously on EMCast. This particular article in the last 6 or 7 months deals with post-cardiac arrest, who needs to go for cath. And I think all of us agree, you've taught us, and we've discussed on prior podcasts, that if we've got a STEMI immediately pre-arrest, or we get a patient back and in the next few minutes, we're getting our post-arrest EKG and it shows a STEMI, well, the AHA says class 1, get that patient emergently off for cardiac intervention or coronary angiography. But by far and away, the more common scenario is that we've got a non-diagnostic or an NSTEMI in essence in the post-arrest setting. And what should we do with those patients? Should we really strongly be pushing for, regardless of whether we've got a STEMI or an NSTEMI type of post-arrest patient, that we need to get them to emergent coronary angiography? And to that end, recall that I think back in 2019, the COAC trial was published, in which that was a randomized trial done in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patients with a shockable rhythm, randomizing them to go immediately to the cath lab versus delayed cath lab intervention, getting them up to the unit and then sending them to cath based upon certain clinical parameters or patient parameters. And that COAC trial showed that there actually wasn't a difference in getting patients off immediately to the cath lab. It didn't improve their primary or secondary outcome. And one of the criticisms, or actually two of the criticisms of that COAC trial, was that it was only in shockable rhythm patients. And at the end of the day, only about 4 or 5% actually had an acute thrombotic occlusion that needed PCI. Well, to that end, we now have what's termed the Tomahawk trial. This was published, I think, at the end of August, early September. So just in the last 7 months in New England Journal of Medicine. This was a randomized trial performed across Germany and Denmark, looking at, once again, immediate versus delayed coronary angiography in patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest that did not have a STEMI on the post-arrest EKG. And in the Tomahawk trial, they included adults with both shockable and non-shockable rhythm. And they were randomized, in essence, to immediate angiography, so take them to the cath lab from the ED, or delayed coronary angiography. And in essence, getting them to the ICU, where they would continue to get good critical care support, and at some point later determining if they needed a cath. Well, the primary outcome of the Tomahawk trial, looking at 30-day all-cause mortality with 30-day favorable neurologic outcome or severe neurologic deficit as a secondary outcome. Tomahawk trial had a little over 550 patients, and those that were randomized to immediate angiography, well, nearly all of them got cath, 96%. They got there within 3 hours. And in contrast to the COAC trial, 40% of patients actually in the immediate angiography randomization arm needed revascularization, compared to those that were randomized to delayed angio. Well, they got there a median time of about 2 days after their arrest, and a similar percentage, about 43%, needed revascularization. And well, the take-home message, Amal, no difference in that primary outcome, no difference in the incidence of severe neurologic deficit at 30 days. So when we're thinking about some post-arrest recent articles, and we've got persistent circulatory shock or patients needing pressors after arrest, well, maybe we should reach for norepinephrine based upon the latest trial in intensive care medicine. And when we're thinking who needs to go up to the cath lab, we've now got the COAC trial and the Tomahawk trial stating in patients who don't have a STEMI, It seems to be better. There's always exceptions, but in general, it seems that it's better to get those patients to the ICU, continue good critical care support, looking at oxygenation, ventilation, targeting better MAPS, thinking about detecting seizures, TTM for who's appropriate, and then at some point after their ICU admission, getting them off to cath for those who are felt to need that intervention.
Now, a number of years ago, we had reviewed an article from Journal of the American College of Cardiology by Rab, which looked at the literature of the time. I think it was published maybe 2015 or so, around then. And based on the literature of the time, they had promoted this concept of, obviously, if the patient has a post-arrest STEMI, then you're going to the cath lab in pretty much all cases. And if they have a post-arrest non-ST elevation ACS looking EKG, what they had strongly endorsed was to consider these unfavorable resuscitation features and things like if they're very acidotic, if it's a traumatic arrest, if they have big time metabolic problems and so on, or long downtime, unwitnessed arrest, all those factors that you know the patient's going to have a bad outcome, they say, don't go to the cath lab. And if they don't have these unfavorable resuscitation features, they say you probably should err on the side of going to the cath lab, but either way, discuss it with cardiology. And we actually put together, as you know, an algorithm here at university, which pushed for contacting cardiology and discussing all of those cases. But now, based on these two recent articles, the COACT study and the Tomahawk study, saying that the non-ST elevation ACS cases really don't show benefit by going immediately to the cath lab, my long-winded question for you is, do you still feel compelled to call cardiology and discuss the case, or do you feel that the literature is pretty sound to say, you know what, if there's no STEMI, then I'm not going to bother calling cardiology at 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm just going to get him admitted to the ICU and cardiology can see him during normal business hours later in the day. What's your approach?
So I think based upon these two fairly well done studies, I'm moving in the direction of the latter. Now, having said that, there's always going to be some select scenarios where I'm still going to call and discuss it. And I think looking back at the AHA and us having familiarity with the guidelines, if that patient is, I guess, electrically or cardiovascular or hemodynamically unstable, we're still going to have that conversation. But I do think that these latest two articles give us much stronger and higher quality evidence to really essentially be admitting most of these folks, getting them up to the unit.
I think that certainly does make sense. Okay, well, let's move off the topic of cardiac arrest and post-arrest, and let's talk about some other aspects of resuscitation. And one of the other topics that you had mentioned had to do with intubation, specifically rapid sequence intubation. And you had some interesting new articles from the past year that talked about RSI. Can you take us through those?
Absolutely. So we're going to do one article on RSI, then two on mechanical ventilation that have some really, really important take-home points. But let's do the RSI article. And recall a few years ago, there was a single center study done in the northern central part of the US, that in that single center where they looked at difficult airway characteristics in ED intubation during critically ill intubations, that study suggested in patients that are thought to have difficult airway characteristics, there was a higher first pass success rate when you just went straight for the bougie first, rather than using the endotracheal tube with stylet. Fairly convincing or impressive increases in first pass success. So really thinking, well, forget the endotracheal tube with stylet. I'm just always going to do my laryngoscopy, direct or video, and then ask for the bougie. Well, we now have aptly termed the bougie trial as a randomized parallel group study across 7 EDs and 8 ICUs across 11 US hospitals. So now we're expanding beyond a single site, looking at the effect of bougie first versus endotracheal tube with stylet on the outcomes of intubation.
This was really called the bougie trial. Are you just making this up, Mike?
I'm not. It says it right there in the parentheses from the bougie investigators, but it's called the bougie trial.
All right.
All right. Well, that has to win an award for the most appropriate name of a trial for, I mean, the tomahawk study you mentioned. When you said tomahawk, I'm thinking of a steak or a weapon of some type, but bougie trial. Wow. That's very impressive. All right. Well, sorry to interrupt, but I just had to verify that you're not making this stuff up.
I'm not making it up whatsoever. So they included adult critically ill patients who needed intubation, whereby the person doing the intubation was going to use RSI or sedation and also was going to use a non-hyperangulated blade for intubation. They didn't include, and this is important, they didn't include the crashing patient that needed immediate intubation, whereby they really couldn't randomize them to bougie first or endotracheal tube with stylet. And in essence, they were randomized to one of those two arms. Routinely just use the bougie during the first attempt or grab the endotracheal tube with that malleable stylet with a distal bend of about 25 to 35 degrees. And their overall primary outcome, first pass success, followed by the secondary outcome of the incidence of severe hypoxemia. So when saturations dropped below 80%. Well, the bougie trial had over 1,100 patients, and the most common actually intubator was emergency medicine. A little over 60% of patients were intubated by an EM physician, and actually most of them were residents. 62% were performing this intubation. And the take-home message, first pass success, no different. No different between using bougie first versus endotracheal tube with stylet. No difference in the incidence of severe hypoxemia, no difference in the incidence of adverse events or airway complications. And I think now looking at this trial, now that we've spread it out to multiple sites rather than a single center, we can delve down in that many of these operators had some, but not the expertise and experience with bougie as we saw with many of those from that single center study. And I think another important thing just to take home on the bougie trial is they weren't looking at this as the bougie as rescue device. This was upfront, going to it routinely all the time, grabbing it first. And so I don't know that I would take away from the bougie trial that we should no longer be considering the bougie and that it doesn't make a difference. I very much think that there are difficult airways and that this needs to be in our airway management armamentarium. But I think routinely and always grabbing it first, thinking that it will increase our first pass success, we now have got the bougie trial to demonstrate probably doesn't do that, but still keep it at hand, keep it in the room, think about it as your plan B, plan C in terms of your airway management. Well, let's just say we now got the patient intubated. We think that the stressful period is over, but really it's now just beginning because now we've got to set the ventilator. And for a long time, Amal, probably over the past 5, 6, 7 years, we've talked about low tidal volume ventilation in the ED. But over this past decade or so, since we've got literature initially to say, you know, we're not setting this really well in the ED, we've done some things, performance improvement, quality assurance things. Have we actually gotten better at setting low tidal volume ventilation in the ED? And the most important question is, does it impact actually patient outcomes? And now online, ahead of print, in critical care medicine is a systematic review and meta-analysis looking at the use of low tidal volume ventilation in ED patients where they looked for randomized, non-randomized cohort, all those type of studies on adults receiving invasive ventilation, whereby those particular studies looked at an ED patient population that either got low tidal volume ventilation or did not get low tidal volume ventilation. And that was defined by these authors as any tidal volume less than or equal to that 8 milliliters per kilogram of predicted body weight. Overall, looking at in-hospital mortality and a few secondary outcomes that we'll talk about momentarily. Well, they found over the past few years, 21 studies investigating low tidal volume ventilation in the ED. And these are the important take-home points. When we used low tidal volume ventilation in the ED, the ICU got better. In other words, there was an increase in the utilization of low tidal volume ventilation in the ICU and overall lower tidal volumes used when patients got upstairs. And when you removed one of the studies that really was a significant outlier, it made a difference. In fact, mortality was lower when patients had low tidal volume ventilation used in the ED versus not. They spent less time on the vent. They spent less time in the ICU. They spent less time overall in the hospital, and they had an overall lower incidence of developing ARDS when they were upstairs in the unit. So I think the message is clear that ED ventilator settings matter. They truly do matter in so many aspects of patient care that while we have gotten better over the last decade, we still have some room for improvement. And quite honestly, our patients benefit when we get it right downstairs in the ED. And lastly, before we round out this sort of section here on recessed articles, we intubate them. We set the ventilator right. And now we need to think another critical aspect of ED mechanical ventilation, and that's post-intubation sedation. Specifically, looking at this concept of awareness with paralysis. What do I mean by that? Patients have received a paralytic, but not an adequate amount of sedation. So they are paralyzed, Amal, but they're awake and they're aware of what's happening to them. And when you look at patients in the anesthesia literature that have been awake but paralyzed, so this awareness with paralysis, that is a tremendous risk factor for long-term mental health issues such as PTSD, anxiety disorders, certain phobias, major depressive disorders. It truly does impact a significant percentage of patients. And when you look at that anesthesia literature, the incidence of this is about 0.1 or 0.2%. But what is it in the ED? Well, about, I would say several months ago, we'll say 9-10 months ago, in Annals of Emergency Medicine, the ED awareness study was published. And now, admittedly, this was a single center, but they wanted to estimate the prevalence of this awareness with paralysis in ED patients. So these were adult patients vented in the ED, and they went through a series of questionnaires, validated tools to assess awareness with paralysis. They included 380 plus patients, and the overall incidence was not 0.1 or 0.2% like we see in the anesthesia literature. It actually was 2.6% prevalence of patients aware but paralyzed. And Amal, the main risk factor, the highest risk factor associated with awareness with paralysis was actually the receipt of rocuronium during the ED RSI or at any time during their ED course. And many of us have kind of moved to rocuronium as a paralytic in terms of RSI. And with respect to the exposure to rocuronium and the difference between those that had awareness with paralysis, 70% got exposed to ROC or received ROC versus 30% received succinylcholine. So taking a big step back, key take-home points. The Bougie trial showed us that, well, we don't necessarily need to routinely and always use Bougie first to increase our chances of first pass success. Clearly, it's an important adjunct in our airway management armamentarium, and we're not dissuading you from anybody from using it, but the Bougie trial showed to use it in all comers, probably not necessary. Low tidal volume ventilation, probably if I had to cite one article in what we're talking about, this is probably the most important because what we do, what we set on the ventilator in the ED matters. It truly does decrease mortality, decrease duration of mechanical ventilation, ICU hospital length of stay, the frequency of ARDS, and it makes the ICU better as well. And lastly, when you have that patient, you've got them intubated, please, there is a not insignificant number of patients that we have initiated ventilation on and are still paralyzed, but aware and awake. And it really behooves us to pay close, close attention and really truly administer adequate amounts of post-intubation analgesia and sedation and ensure that patients have sedation when they're on the ventilator throughout their ED course.
You know, I'm not surprised about the whole rocuronium issue. I love ROC also, and we routinely use rocuronium in our emergency department, as you know. But there are plenty of times where the intubation occurs, and then people ask for the sedation, the propofol, for example. And if it's not already in the room, it takes 5-10 minutes for somebody to run out, get the probe, mix it up, hang it. And by then, probably whatever the induction agent was has worn off. You know, back when you and I first started learning intubation, we would routinely use midazolam or benzodiazepines, which last a lot longer, and they have their drawbacks. But now the induction agents have gotten so good, so efficient, the etomidate, the propofol, you know, that they work very quickly and they don't last very long. And if you don't have the ongoing sedation agent ready to go at the time you put the endotracheal tube in all likelihood, by the time you get it ready, the patient's going to wake up. So I try to tell the residents that don't push any drugs for the RSI unless you have the propofol in the room hanging ready to go. And of course, that's presuming the patient's not crashing. But I think it is a problem, and it's not surprising to hear those statistics.
Yeah, that's a nice practice that you have. And we've, even in our ED, we've incorporated post-intubation analgesia and sedation as part of our RSI checklist to make sure that somebody's working on preparing that as we're actually getting ready to do RSI.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to our last topic. And that has to do with a topic that I know you love to talk about, and that is fluids. So what's the latest on IV fluids in the critically ill patient?
That's right. Well, we've talked about fluids with respect to balance solutions versus saline for quite some time. And we got to be aware of two articles published in the last 6 or 7 months. The first, the basics trial, and then more recently, the PLUS trial. So I'm not going to do a deeper-ish dive on the basics trial other than to let folks know it's in JAMA, published August, I believe, in 2021. This was a randomized trial out of 75 ICUs in Brazil, looking at, does the administration of a balanced solution during their ICU stay improve 90-day mortality in critically ill patients randomized to get balanced fluids or randomized to get saline? And that take-home message was it actually didn't matter. In fact, the use of Plasmalite 148 didn't change 90-day mortality compared with those that got saline when it was administered to critically ill ICU patients. Well, let's do a deeper-ish dive on the PLUS study. And this was just published just within the last 3 months in New England Journal. This was a randomized trial, 53 centers in Australia and New Zealand, looking at, does a balanced multi-electrolyte solution, i.e. Plasmalite 148, lower 90-day mortality in critically ill patients when compared to saline? So who were these folks? These were adult patients admitted to the ICU, not in the ED, not necessarily in that salvage phase of resuscitation, but in the ICU. The clinician treating team determined, well, they need fluids, and they were expected to be in the ICU at least 3 days. And in essence, they were randomized to either get this balanced multi-electrolyte solution, Plasmalite 148, or normal saline. And that therapy was continued, that fluid, specific fluid was continued for up to 90 days while they were in the ICU. Now, many don't spend 90 days in the ICU. So if they went out from the ICU to a floor, fluid wasn't restricted, wasn't dictated based upon the study protocol. And what was their primary outcome? Well, it was 90-day all-cause mortality with a number of secondary outcomes that we would commonly look at in critically ill trials regarding ventilation time, pressor time, need for renal replacement therapy. So what were those results? The PLUS trial enrolled a little over 5,000 patients, almost half of which almost came to the ICU from the OR or PACU. So almost half of the patients in this trial weren't coming from the ED, weren't critically ill or crashing, but they were going to the ICU. They needed fluids and were supposed to be there or anticipated to be there for at least 3 days. Well, the median volume of fluid in the PLUS trial was much higher than what we've seen in other trials, even the recent BASICS trial. Folks in this trial actually got a median volume of anywhere between 3.7 to almost 4 liters. So much higher than that 1 to 1.1 or 1.5 liters we're used to seeing in previous trials on balanced solution. And 90-day all-cause mortality was no different between those that got Plasmalite 148 versus those that got saline. No difference in secondary outcomes. But I think it's important, once again, just to highlight those limitations. They ended up stopping enrollment in the PLUS study. They had targeted 8,000 patients, but it was clear due to COVID and a variety of things, they weren't going to hit that 8,000 target. So they stopped after 5,000. They reran some of their numbers and felt they had enough to meet statistical significance if one existed. The other limitation, I would say, or two limitations, one I've mentioned is that they didn't control for the type of fluid that was given to these patients once they got out of the ICU. About half came from the OR, and then they used Plasmolite 148. And so when there's various Plasmolite solutions, this has a pH that's a little closer to normal saline. And while I mentioned all of those limitations, and you would think that I'm driving more towards saying, keep going with your balanced fluid, it's important to say that these two studies have not shown a difference in 90-day all-cause mortality in ICU patients randomized to get Plasmolite 148 versus saline. Now, lastly, and we'll kind of bring this discussion to a close, there was a meta-analysis that's online ahead of print in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine that included patients in the PLUS trial. And the conclusion of that meta-analysis is there still does seem to be a higher probability in sick, critically ill patients. There may be there's a higher probability that the mortality is lower in those that are receiving balanced fluids. But I think it's important to present the evidence here, discuss these articles, bring these two important articles and contributions to the fluid literature to all of our listeners and have them review the studies and then determine what's best for the patient that's in front of them in their ED.
I know that you've always been a fan of Plasmolite, so kudos to you for presenting these articles, which have shown that perhaps there is no significant benefit. I'll also add that Mike is not paid by any fluid company out there. And if he were, there's not a lot of money in fluid. Plasmolite is cheap. And that's one of the saving graces also in that even when you advocate for the use of Plasmolite, it's not an expensive thing. But it will be interesting to see how future literature pans out as to whether one fluid or the other is better for certain types of sick patients, or maybe it has to do with how much fluid you're giving. I mean, it certainly intuitively seems like a bad idea to give normal saline in somebody in whom you're giving 3, 4, 5 liters, because you are going to induce that hyperchloremic acidosis. And if they're just getting 1 or 2 liters, maybe those are the patients in whom, you know what, it really doesn't make a difference. So we'll have to see how the future studies pan out.
Yeah.
Well, we've gone through some really great articles focusing on resuscitation from the past year, focused on cardiac arrest and post-arrest and intubation and vent issues and fluids. And this has been a great series of educational articles that you've presented. And I always look forward to these every year. And hopefully we'll be getting some more articles on this later in the year as they get published. I appreciate it, Mike. Thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely, Amal. I could not be more appreciative of the opportunity to speak with you, speak with all of our listeners. My thanks, and I'll look forward to future conversations.
Sounds great, Mike. Once again, thanks so much, and we will undoubtedly talk again real soon.
Bye for now.
All right. Well, next up on EMCast, we have a special first-time guest, Dr. David Carr. Dr. Carr is an associate professor at the University Health Network in Toronto, and he's a wonderful gentleman that I've had a chance to get to know over the years through some conferences in Toronto, and he's really one of the outstanding educators that I've gotten to know and very well read, and he's got an interesting array of topics that he's addressed at conferences. And this is actually not a conference topic that I asked him to talk about, but he's relatively active on social media. And he probably a month ago or so, I guess, he sent out a tweet asking for people across the Twitterverse their thoughts about how to do a good consult in emergency medicine. This is a topic that's so important to our practice for emergency medicine. How do you consult people? What do you say? How do you initiate it? And we've never actually addressed this topic before. So after seeing some of the responses we got, I thought this would be a great thing to address. So first of all, David, welcome to the EMCast. It's so great to have you. And I hope to get you on board for some other topics But let me first of all start out by just asking a simple question. What got you interested in this topic? What made you want to send out a tweet and get a, kind of a survey or get opinions about how to do consults in emergency medicine?
Yeah, thanks for the introduction and your kind words. You know, it really stemmed, to be very honest, with kind of a WhatsApp group of people in different hospitals, in different chat groups that I'm in, kind of saying like, oh, I gave this consult, I had so much pushback. And there was all this stuff about, I find that when I give consults, I get pushback. That was kind of a sentiment that was echoed. And, you know, I've paid attention to this over a year, and I kind of want, you know, some people stated, you know, I have trouble giving consults, and other people, you kind of looked and said, okay, well, maybe your stories aren't that clear. And other people said, I have trouble giving consults. And you said, really? You're like so succinct. You're so smart. How is that possible? Everything you say is like gold. And I wanted to set out to say, is there something underlying that makes consults not well received? And is there stuff that we need to learn or we need to teach?
Really important. And a few people have actually done little mini lectures that I've heard at various conferences, especially for students and residents. But I think even as an attending, there are some tips that I thought I picked up from reading some of the responses. And it's a really valuable skill, especially during a busy shift. So let's jump into this. What were some of the interesting responses you got? Which, and I'm also interested in seeing if there's any things that changed your practice since you're a fairly experienced attending.
I'll tell you what, I actually, like you, was pretty surprised at the feedback. Like, I had about 250,000 impressions on Twitter for a topic that you and I are hardcore clinicians. As you said, this isn't a clinical topic, but it really blew up because I think people care about it. And, you know, there was always this, In one of our WhatsApp group, there was a gendering lens. And I wanted to know, is it something about the way consults are given? Is it the way that there's lack of respect for certain people? And I just said, you know what, let me put this out there. So what was interesting is what came up, and I would say over and over and again, was this mnemonic bluff. And bluff, not spelled the way that you would think, but B-L-U-F, which is a mnemonic I'd never heard of, which stands for bottom line up front. And everyone said bluff, bluff, bluff. And I was like, I've never heard that. But that is the essential element of giving the consult. And I kind of structured this in thinking about, okay, how do you prepare to give the consult? How do you deliver the consult? And how do you deal with pushback? And I got some great tips that I'd love to share with you if you got time.
I haven't heard that bluff either before, but why don't you go ahead and tell us what some of the tips that you picked up were.
So with bluff, bottom line up front, I think the key is the introduction. And I think the first thing is, you know, who you are. So you pick up the phone and you say, hi, it's David Carr, one of the eMERGE staff, or something like that. So I introduce myself and I give a rank. It's funny because some people call themselves, hi, it's Dr. Mattu. And some people say it's Amal. And sometimes I say, hi, it's David Carr, one of the eMERGE staff. And the person says back, hi, it's Dr. Singh, the ortho resident. And it's like, okay, we can go titles there. But I think it's important to say who you are. And then the next thing is to say, I want to get you involved to consult on a patient, and I give the patient's name and medical record number and location. I think that I'm ready, and I also know who I'm speaking to, because I think it's important, and we all probably know this, and it's unspoken, that different specialties, and we'll get to it when we talk about it, want sort of a different story. The other overwhelming response on Twitter was be kind, be nice, be sweet, and even ask the person on the other end of the day, how are you feeling? How are you doing? How goes? What up? So I think that be kind was a really helpful tip. And I always try to be polite. And I think it just kind of starts the process properly.
That's a great tip. Yeah, that's a great tip. And one of the other things I'm just going to highlight that you said, the way you introduce yourself, first of all, you introduce yourself and want to find out who the other person is. And it is always frustrating when the other person says, this is ortho. So it sounds like you like to get people's names.
And, don't you find like it's just human nature that when we discuss, like I also don't say, hi, is this ortho?
Right.
Because I don't think that's human. And Amal, you and I are academics and we work in academic hospitals where we speak to trainees, whether it's medical students or residents. And a lot of the times they may not know who you are or who I am. And on the flip side is we probably don't know who they are. Whereas if you're working in a community hospital where you know who's on call and it's Dr. Jones and you call her and you say, hey, Jen, it's Dave. What's up? I have one for you. It's a much easier thing. So I think we take those steps for granted when we know the person on the other phone. But if you're an academic and you don't know who you're calling to, who the off-service resident is who's picking up the phone, I think it's important to make that introduction.
Sure, sure. So very important. The other thing that you mentioned or that you stated when you gave kind of the sample introduction was you jumped right in and gave them the patient information, meaning the patient name, the medical record number, maybe you're going to give them what room they're in. And this is what I would like from you, a consult or maybe to admit the patient. And I found that that's really helpful also, as opposed to, hey, Dr. Smith from Orthopedics, I've got a patient down here who's a 55-year-old who has a history of diabetes and hyperlipidemia. And, you know, it's like presenting a whole history and they're on the other line thinking, well, what the heck do you want from me? But you started right out with, there's a patient here that I'd like you to consult on. So right up front, you're stating kind of an expectation. And I think that's really, really nice and important as well.
Yeah. Bottom line up front, right? Bottom line up front. I think the best piece of advice, and I'd love to hear your thought on as well on this, is everyone said, and I'm talking so many people, said, don't apologize for the consult. You are an advocate for the patient. If you apologize, that creates a power struggle and a difference. And it's so interesting because I often will start things like, I'm so sorry to call you at this time of the day. I'm, you know, but at the end of the day is, if you have a patient with appendicitis, they need to see a surgeon no matter what the time is, if that's the culture in your shop. And I think a lot of the times we feel bad for giving internal medicine consults because we know we've given them three in the last 3 hours, but it's kind of not our fault.
I agree with that also. I don't know that I would be dogmatic about that. I've heard people go at kind of both ends of that equation. I've heard some people say, you know, it's just a way of empathizing with your consultant who may be extremely busy. And it's not, it may not necessarily be putting power in their place by apologizing to them, but it's kind of the old saying that when you walk into a room and see a patient, the first thing that you might say is, hi, this is Dr. Mattu. I'm really sorry you've had to wait so long. What can I do? You know, that type of thing.
No, so, which is amazing, right?
Yeah. I don't feel strongly okay. Either way, but it is interesting that you got a lot of replies saying, don't apologize as you begin.
Because I always did. And I always do. And I just feel like maybe it's the way I was raised in manners. And I always would feel bad calling someone at 5 a.m. if I have to. And I'm always someone who tries to be very resident advocate, resident friendly, and not call someone at 5:30 in the morning to say, we're running CBI and it won't clear. You know, I'll wait to the morning to call the resident because I just don't think it's necessary to ruin their night's sleep. So sure. I think I hear what you're saying. I'm maybe in your camp, but so many people said, don't ever apologize. And I said, okay, well, I understand their point.
That's interesting.
Know? Yeah.
So what else did you hear from the
yeah, majority? So that's kind of my general kind of take. And then there's how to deliver a consult. So we talked about bluff. I think though it's really important, and you kind of acknowledged it, is you're not asking their opinion, you're wanting a consult. And if you start the interaction with, yeah, you know, I have this person and I really don't know what to do with them. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, there are times when you might have a specific question you want addressed, but when you want to have them see the patient, you need to make it very clear, I have a consult for you. Not I want you to deal with this over the phone, unless you say, hey, I'm wondering if you can just help me to expedite this person's care. But I'm very upfront in what I ask. The ask has to be communicated. The other thing I think, which is important, is you need to prioritize urgency. So yes, can you see Mrs. Lee next? You know what? I know I've given you a few consults, but you know, her blood pressure is a little labile. Her lactate's 4.5. She's, you know, a febrile newt. I've given her some Piptazo. I think of the consults I've given you, I think she would be the one I would see next. And I think you need to be honest. We don't want to sell consults. We want to be honest. And you need to make sure you close that loop in that you tell people what to expect, how urgent it is, and make sure you're on the same page as them.
Yeah, I like those tips. That's really useful. Also, the prioritizing the urgency. I don't think that that happens too often, but I think it's a really, really great tip. And also, again, remembering that you're not really asking their opinion, but just coming right out and saying, this is what I need from you. There's a patient out here that I would like you to see. And that just sets the expectation right up front.
Look, I think in your prep work to deliver consults, you have to do your homework. I think you have to know immaculately the consultation policies in your hospital. For example, in our hospital, if you have pancreatitis and you're a drinker, it goes to medicine. But if you're not a drinker, it goes to surgery. That may be something different in every shop you work at. You know, we admit people with chest pain to internal medicine unless their troponin's positive or they've had a recent cath or their ECG is concerning. And sometimes the person you're on the phone with is coming from, in our shop in Toronto, they might have rotated through another hospital where things are very different. So you need to know your local shop in terms of what the consultation policies, and sometimes that needs to be communicated in a polite fashion to the person on the phone if they're not familiar.
Great tips.
I think one of the things people talked about is, you know, who you're speaking to. I mean, there's no doubt, and we probably stereotype as it is, but like for me, when I consult Gen Surge with appendicitis, it's I have a person, room 6, CT proven appendicitis, gave some ANSEP and flagyl, white counts 9, afebrile, looks well, she's ready to be seen. It's not a more elaborate history because I know what they want or don't want. And I hope I know the pertinent positives and negatives, but I think you and I both can take the leap to say that obviously you need to do your homework and you need to know a full social and domestic history if it's a complicated referral. And the reason referral is not so clear cut and binary as they have appendicitis needs to come in.
Yeah. With the surgeons, you're pretty cut and dry and you just jump. The example you gave is if you're consulting for appendicitis, you just jumped right to the CAT scan. It's positive. They always want the white count, of course. And there's a patient who's now ready to be seen. Do you find that there's a significant difference amongst the different specialties and any specific tips for this specialty versus that specialty?
Yeah, look, I hope you get to work. You know, one of the things we did in our shop a while ago is we had the internal medicine residents rotate where they were going to be senior residents. They would rotate through the hospital where they were going to be seniors. So they got to know the attendings in the emergency department. So there was an understanding because the reality is majority of your consults, at least I'm sure, go to internal medicine, and that ED, GIM relationship needs to be, you know, robust and strong. I think that, you know, ideally you get to know people over the course of their rotations and their residencies, and there's faith and trust that, hey, you aren't someone who just thinks, not a referologist.
You're not a referologist. I love that term. Well, unfortunately, the internet had some problems during the next small portion. Maybe COVID infected some of the Wi-Fi. But anyway, the next thing Dave talked about was something that he's done recently, which is actually when working with the students or maybe the junior level residents, he will actually have them go through the entire consult, do a practice consult to him, sometimes even recording it and give feedback based on that before they actually get online with the consultant and present the actual consult. Now, this can be in real time if you have time. If you're in a bit of a rush, then you can always provide the feedback afterwards. But I think this idea of doing a simulated consult and then providing feedback about the recording is just a fantastic, fantastic idea for educators out there.
Now, you and I both supervise a lot of learners, and I think one of the great points, and Ian Beardsill from the St. Emlyn's Group really talked about one of the most important things you need to do in emergency medicine is give a consult. And he surmised that at the end of the day is it's probably not a skill that we spend enough teaching on. And, you know, I was really enthused to chat tonight. And I had a student working with me today. And what I decided to do when I saw her giving consults was, you know what, why don't we role play and why don't we do some deliberate practice? So, you know, instead of this complicated surgical referral. Why don't you give it to me first and I'll be the surgeon on call to speak to you. And she really appreciated it. And it's something that I've always done with my learners, because I think it makes your job so much easier if you can give consults and they're received well. Do you do the same thing?
Probably not often enough. With the medical students, we will sometimes do that, especially if it's a complicated patient. We'll say, okay, well, why don't we just practice the consult first? But definitely not often enough. And even for the interns, I think it would be helpful for them to do this more often.
And you and I have probably both sat there where our resident was on the phone speaking and you can see them struggling.
Oh my God.
And you just want to take the phone from them and say, let me just help you out. Like phone a friend, like I'll do it. But they need to see that. And I think it comes back to bluff. Like if the consultation starts with, hi, I'm one of the, you know, the residents working with Dr. Mattu, and I don't know, we have this patient, I'm not really sure if it goes to medicine or cardiology or nephrology or hematology, and I don't really know what to do, and I'm not sure, they're just going to get
frustrated.
Frustrated. And sometimes you can tell that they're having a challenge, but I think we need to make a real emphasis on making sure our residents, especially our emergency medicine residents, they know how to give consults well, because this will make their life simpler.
Yeah, I totally agree. It is a skill that's probably just as important as knowing how to evaluate chest pain and other clinical topics.
And I know that's got to be a big thing for you to say. So
I didn't say reading EKG.
Yeah, no, I noticed that. But that's close. No,
but that's, I mean, close. From a practical standpoint, in terms of being a functional person, a functional clinician in the emergency department, there are certain things that you have to know how to do. You have to know how to communicate with the nurses. You have to know how to communicate with the patients, and you have to know how to communicate with the consultants. And this is key with
for sure. I think the two most underrated skills in emergency medicine are communicating bad news and communicating consults effectively. And both of them will make your life better and your patient's life better too.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that.
I wanted to just tell you what Chris Nixon said, because Chris Nixon has this approach that really kind of sums up what we've talked about to this point, which is he talks about the five C's. And if you're someone who likes to have an ordered structure approach, he talks about the five C's: contact, communicate, core questions, collaborate, and close the loop. And with contact, Chris says, you know, identify yourself, your role, who you're calling from, who you're speaking to. Communicate, give a concise story, relevant positive negatives, stay pleasant. Core questions, explicitly state what you require the consultants to do and why you need them to come. Collaborate, work together what's best. You know, do you want me to just order that CT of the extremity so you can prep for that, you know, olecranon fracture surgery? And then finally, close the loop. Make sure you are both on the same page when you expect them to come down, when they're going to be finishing their OR. And I like those five C's because I think it just summarized the last 10 minutes of our talk.
Very nice. I like that also.
I think that we can't go through a discussion on consultations to think that it's all going to be rosy and it's all going to be peachy. And no matter how sweet and kind you are, at the end of the day, you are going to be faced with conflict. And one, obviously, this is the major source. And I think this is the hard part of the job. And it was great to hear people's piece. I think Nixon said it best when he said, be soft on people, but be hard on issues. And I think the most important thing with conflict you have to realize is you can't take this personally. This is not someone who thinks you're stupid, or hey, maybe they do, but this is about advocating for patients. And it's not, if they don't want to take the consults, you can't be offended. You can't take it personally. You have to advocate.
Yeah, I think that making it about the patient and not making it an ego battle between who gets to win, you versus the consultant, is really key. And I think you're alluding to that. Really keeping the focus on what's going to be best for the patient can sometimes be very helpful in terms of those difficult conversations with the consultants.
Yeah, look, you don't want to accept bad advice from good consultants. And I think this comes down to knowing who the people are. Sometimes you just frankly get bad advice. I remember I was speaking to someone who had a fever and lower urinary tract symptoms and a white count and a kidney stone with irritable pain. And I spoke to the urology service and I said, I have this person with an infected stone who's sick, a febrile white count. And they said, just give them some Cipro and send them home. And I kind of knew that wasn't the right advice. And I did something, and not in a condescending way. I said, you know, just for my comfort level, can you just let me know what year of training you're in? And I don't want to be condescending, right, but, you know, sometimes you get bad advice, and it's very different if you get bad advice from attending staff, then you get a bad advice from maybe an off-service resident covering a surgical subspecialty who may know less than you about that patient and how to manage them.
The difficult consult is a question that comes up an awful lot. Even, for example, when I'm lecturing about chest pain, for example, I might talk about which patients need to be admitted, which patients need to go to the cath lab. And one of the very frequent questions that I get, in fact, a question I got earlier today was, what do you do when you call the interventional cardiologist and they don't agree with you, and you've got literature backing you up in your pocket and they're not next to you to hand it to? What do you do when you really believe you're doing the right thing and they just don't want to do it? How do you manage that? Any tips for that?
Yeah, it's super tough when you're speaking staff to staff. And it's funny because I remember when you first put Brugada on the scene 20 years ago or so, and we were telling people about entities they hadn't heard of. And I think that sometimes I will say, like, are you familiar with the current managers? I think it's really cool. Actually, the way I've seen people do it this way is this. I don't know if that's what you're doing, but I've been hearing a lot about this through social media and through speaking to other experts. Is this a way you're doing? I think you want to acknowledge to them that people don't want to be made to be insulted or feel like you're outsmarting them. You want to be respectful. But I think sometimes you could say, look, I've seen this done differently and I've seen some real experts. Maybe you're familiar with this person. She does it this way. I've just seen this way. This is something, I don't know if that's something you want to discuss with another person, but I really feel this is someone who needs to have it done a certain way. And it really comes down to advocacy. And I think no matter what you do, you need to have grace under pressure. You really don't want to raise your voice. You don't want to get angry. You don't want to fight. Once you lose your tone, you've really sunk. And I think staying composed and pushing harder and harder is, I think sometimes you have to go that extra distance. You know, one of the best quotes I ever heard was in regards to how to manage when you're having that struggle, and the struggle was sold to me as, you know, you're calling radiology, it's 3 a.m, you really want to get a study done. And the radiologist, and I don't mean to pick on them, but that's the example, doesn't want to do the test because they need to come in or send a tech. And the line that was used, and it's such an effective line, is, I am sure you can understand the implication of both of us missing this diagnosis. I'm sure you can understand the implication of both of us missing this diagnosis. I think we need to do the CT to rule out that aortic tear. And involving people in the care, putting them in that circle, is so important because they're part of the treatment team now once you made the phone call.
I like that quote also. I haven't heard that. I didn't see that on the Twitter responses, but I really,
it's
really
not
like
from
that.
There, yeah. Yeah. So Amal, Walter Himmel is someone you and I both know. He's a Toronto emergency physician, and he talks a lot about how to deal with difficult people. And I think that Walter really makes it simple. And he keeps stating, you know, I really need your help. I'm not comfortable sending this person home. I'm not comfortable doing this procedure. And one of the most effective tools he talks about is the ability to just pause and complete silence. And he says most consultants will burn out. And he said the amount of time that you stay silent varies between 10 and 30 seconds. So if you say something and then the consultant gets all riled up and they go on this rampage, you don't lose your cool. You pause for 10 to 30 seconds, almost to the point where they think there's been a technical glitch on their iPhone. And then you say, listen, thank you for your opinion. And I respectfully, completely respect you. And that's great. I need you to come see the patient. I really need your help. And eventually you will get what you want because that's just the way it works. And in a final ditch, he'll say, you know, sometimes if you really can't get there with one pause, he'll say, why don't I go quickly reassess the patient and call you right back? And then he goes on to say, they know they're getting the call. It's 2 a.m. And you just go and you go and you call them back, say, I really tried to do what you said. Unfortunately, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And you in your right mind know you're calling them anyways, but at least they feel that you've gone that extra distance for them. But I don't get there. And I don't run into so many problems. And I think part of it is that it's bluff. It's bottom line up front. And I'm also an advocate for patients. And there's not a lot that people are going to do to convince me otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. I like those. I like Walter's approach. And I agree that if you're really upfront, and what Walter's also suggesting is advocating in the patient's best interests. And it almost always tends to work. And I don't know what else to say about those consultants for whom it doesn't work. One of the other things that I would mention is that a number of years ago, we started recording our phone lines. And so, for example, when a consultant calls us back or anybody calls the emergency department, they get a little recording that they hear that this phone line is being recorded. And so that also has changed people's behavior quite a bit. When people know that they are being recorded, it certainly does increase the level of professionalism and gets rid of a lot of arguments. And especially if you can keep your cool, then it forces them to have to keep their cool and really focus on the best patient care as well. I don't know if that's something that you guys do or you've heard of also, but it's something that is worth people looking into if they work in a place where they really have a lot of difficult conversations.
I think that is an incredible thing. We don't do it routinely in the hospital. We have a service called Critical, which is if you're in a community hospital where you, let's say you don't have a neurosurgeon and you have to transfer to a cardiothoracic or neurosurgeon, you would call a central dispatcher who puts you in touch with the closest neurosurgeon, and those calls are recorded. And I can see the deterrent effect of just being polite. And also, look, you work in a more litigious society than we do. And if these calls are recorded and patients and consultants are refusing to see the patient or provide the care, that's not going to look good, because I imagine these calls can be subpoenaed under some act where they're not protected. I think those are great in terms of not for legal protection, but for behavior and a deterrent effect of being rude to, you know, your fellow colleagues.
Yes. Yeah. Very true.
But I mean, I think that's it. I mean, I think, you know, I can't say that this is something that many people have happened to them, that they have to go down these fights, but it can really ruin a shift. And that's what I've seen. And I hope some of the things we talked about, I think that within, you know, it's like speed dating, like within the first 30 seconds, you're going to know if there's a connection. And I think given a consult isn't that dissimilar, within 30 seconds, I know by the body language on the phone whether this is going to be okay. If I'm getting interrupted 25 times in my first minute, I'm going to know this is going to be a problem.
You're going to know it's time to swipe left.
Yes, swipe left. Okay, he's in room 7. Got to go. Bye. You know,
there you go.
I'm not playing this game. Yeah.
David, those are some really, really great pearls that you have dropped on all of us. And some of these things, even after working in the emergency department 26 years, that I will start using. And I think it'll be very helpful and definitely things that I'm going to try to push over to the residents, because I think that they still have a lot to learn and they more frequently encounter difficult conversations with the consultants. And I think these can really, really be helpful. So my thanks to you for initiating this whole conversation in the Twitterverse. And thanks to all those people that responded, because I think it really gave us some great educational points to share with all of our listeners.
Thanks for having me. I was going to say, it was a lot of fun.
All right, folks. Well, it's time for our summary. And we're going to run through some key points from the resuscitation articles and then the consultation discussion. With regards to resuscitation articles, I think there's three main things that we talked about. Number one,
was cardiac arrest. And I just kind of organized these things in kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down, kind of a Siskel and Ebert format. Some of you young folks won't know what that refers to, Siskel and Ebert. But anyway, thumbs up, thumbs down. What are the thumbs up with regards to cardiac arrest? Well, number one, norepinephrine. It appears that norepinephrine is probably preferable to epinephrine. Now, it's not a slam dunk, but I think norepinephrine is probably the first drug to start with if your post-arrest patient is persistently hypotensive. What are the things that didn't work? The thumbs down. Well, number one, routine use of calcium doesn't work. Routinely giving vasopressin plus methylprednisolone. Remember a study on in-hospital cardiac arrest from a number of years ago, and it seemed to be really favorable in that study. And finally, they've restudied it and really did not was not found to be all that useful. And then what about immediate cath for post-arrest patients? And that's been a source of controversy. Mike Winter spent a few minutes talking about the recent Tomahawk study. This Tomahawk study is now the second big article that has been published looking at the concept of routinely taking these patients emergently to the cath lab once they have return of spontaneous circulation. And what we know is that post-arrest STEMI patients are probably, you're justified in sending them to the cath lab, but what about the post-arrest non-ST elevation patients? And this article also supports the prior New England Journal study, which showed no immediate benefits. So focus on resuscitation of the patient, stabilize them, get them admitted, and then cardiology can think about sending them to the cath lab maybe a day or so later. And then the third major thing that we talked about was the ever-present, unending, not going anywhere topic of using epinephrine during cardiac arrest. And the most recent data, once again, supports the idea that epinephrine can probably increase survival, but not necessarily with neurologic outcome. And of course, there's always this slight trend towards suggesting that maybe the neurologic outcome might be a little bit worse. So it's really going to be up to you about whether you want to keep using epinephrine or not. My personal preference is that I'll use epinephrine for about the first 20 minutes, every 5 minutes or so for several doses. And then after that, I'm not a big fan of epinephrine. Well, next, we talked about intubation issues and what are the key things to know about intubation. Well, number one, routine use of the bougie is really not all that it's chalked up to be. There are some prior studies from maybe several years ago that suggested that maybe routinely using the bougie with every intubation is going to increase your success rate. And according to this study, it probably doesn't. Mike talked about a study which suggested, yeah, you know what, use the bougie when you have a difficult intubation, but otherwise you don't have to use the bougie routinely. Mike also talked about low tidal volumes in the emergency department. We'll give that a thumbs up. We'll give the routine use of bougie a thumbs down. And then the other key thing that Mike talked about in the discussion was patients who are not sedated enough and they can have some recollection of the intubation and the god-awful feeling of being paralyzed, yet still being a bit awake. And one of the most predictive factors associated with that happening was the use of rocuronium. And it makes sense because patients are paralyzed and it lasts so long that it gives the sedative a chance to wear off. And yet because the patient's still paralyzed, you don't know that they're awake. So how do you get around that? Well, you could just go back to using succinylcholine, but we're still big fans of rocuronium. So I think what you need to do is you need to make sure that at the time of intubation, you've got your sedative set up and ready to go, and you get them started immediately after you pass that tube. Don't wait. Don't order it after the intubation. Order it before the intubation so it's already there and ready to go. And then the third topic that Mike talked about in his list of resuscitation articles was IV fluids. And we all know that Mike is a big fan of balanced IV fluids, but we're going to have to give that a thumbs down for now in that it does not appear, based on the most recent literature, that there is a significant benefit to using balanced IV fluids, the Plasmolite or the lactated ringers, routinely in patients with critical medical illness. So if you really want to use the saline, you probably can justify that. I don't think it's a huge issue because, frankly, the balanced IV fluids are fairly cheap anyway. And if you're going to give whopping amounts of fluid, then you are going to induce a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis by using multiple liters of normal saline. But if we're talking 1 or 2 liters, you know what? It probably doesn't make a big difference in terms of what type of fluids that you use. So we'll try to keep that balanced IV fluid discussion balanced in that sense. Well, our second topic to finish off this month's issue of EMCast was the topic of speaking with consultants. We really don't teach how to do consultations appropriately or enough during medical school and certainly even during residency training. David Carr had sent out an interesting Twitter poll and got some really great tips that he was willing to share with us. Number one was this concept of bluff, B-L-U-F, bottom line up front. When you're calling your consultant, give them the bottom line up front. Tell them right up front what you want from them. He went through a series of steps that you can use with the consultation. Number one, identify who you are and who they are. Don't just settle for, this is ortho, this is neurosurgery, this is cardiology. No, get somebody's name, make it personal. It's just more, as David said, it's more human to do that. Then provide the patient's identifying information, what room they are, medical record number, and then let them know what you want. Start out with, there's a patient down here that we want to have you see in the emergency department, or there's a patient down here that we would like you to admit to your service. So they know right up front what the issues are. And then go ahead and provide critically useful information for them that's going to help them make their decision. You don't have to give a full history of physical, but just give them the critically useful information. And David also talked about this idea of trying to be kind and nice. See how the consultant's doing. Some people may disagree with that and just be very, very cut and dry. You know, I'm not going to be your friend on this consultation. But you know what? That again, that's not really human. It's worth trying to be collegial on the phone. And that especially helps avoid a lot of disputes and disagreements. It's much harder for people to argue with you when you're being nice to them than when you're being kind of dry and insincere or not friendly. David talked about something that he likes to promote, this concept of five C's, contact. In other words, identify who you are in your role and find out who they are. Next C is communicate, give the concise story. Next C is core questions, explicitly tell them what you want the consultant to do. The next C is collaborate, try to work together and make it all about what's in the patient's best interest. And then the final C is close the loop. Make sure you both are on the same page and your consultant knows what you want of them. So again, the five C's, contact, communicate, core questions, collaborate, and close the loop. And above all, always make sure that it's not a battle of you versus the consultant, but everything should be focused on what is going to be best for the patient and advocate for the patient. All right, folks. Well, that concludes our June issue of EMed Home's EMCast. My thanks to Mike Winters and David Carr for providing us some really great discussion points for this month. I hope you are able to take these points right back to your emergency department and use them on your very next shift. I know I'm going to be able to use a handful of these on my next shift, certainly on my next consultation. And I look forward to talking to all of you next month. Until then, please take care.
Hey, thanks for listening to EMCast. And for listening to the end, here's a discount code for you. Use discount code PODCAST for 10% off each year of an annual subscription to emedhome.com.